All right. We'll grab your Bibles, open them up to Psalm chapter 2. Last week we started a new sermon series on the book of Psalms, and I promised you that I would not preach every single psalm. But last week we did Psalm 1, today we are doing Psalm 2, and you might be thinking, wait a second, this is just the sort of thing that pastors do. So I want to be clear, that isn't the case. I'm going to double down on the promise. We will not be preaching through every psalm. We're going to be doing 16 of them, but there's a reason to do the second psalm, and that is that Psalm 2 acts as kind of the second half of the introduction to the book of Psalms. And it does this in a number of ways. First, while the first psalm begins with blessing and ends with perishing, the second psalm begins with rage and ends with blessing. So you can kind of feel this flow where it's like blessing to perishing, rage back up to blessing. And so it kind of brings us full circle so that we're not left just in the kind of, you know, perishing where we ended last week. Second, the first psalm gives us a perspective on the individual, while the second expands to address the nation. Right? In Psalm 1, it was people. Are they wicked or are they faithful? Which path are they on? Here in Psalm 2, we see the psalmist talking about people in a broader sense, people as a community. And this reveals to us that life is a shared endeavor. You are not just an individual in a sea of other individuals. The task of community building is part of what it means to be the church. This is a group project, and not the kind of group project where one person does all the work and everyone else puts their names on it, right? If you're in high school, you know exactly what I'm talking about. So it brings us back to a place of blessing. It expands our view of kind of who we are and what our responsibility is. And the third thing that this second chapter does is, while the first chapter focused almost exclusively on our spiritual lives, the second chapter really focuses on our physical lives. Now, that isn't to say the first chapter didn't have anything to do with real life and the second chapter doesn't have anything to do with spirituality, but it's more like this. The first chapter was looking at, really, our relationship with God, the spiritual realm, and kind of the application was in the peripheral. Today, we're really going to look at what does it mean to live our lives, and the spiritual is kind of going to be in the margins. This is important because it's easy to forget that these two pieces of our lives are linked. While at times we're more focused on, you know, where we're relating to God, and sometimes, and most of the time, we're more focused on actually living our lives out, our lives aren't compartmentalized and separate. These two pieces don't live in separate spheres. What we do comes from who we believe God to be. And so this second psalm, just like all the rest of the psalms, is here to help orient us to God. Now, it does it from the perspective of kingship, God's kingship over all creation. This is an enthronement psalm. As I said, we're going to do 16 different types of psalms. This is an enthronement psalm. The enthronement psalms specifically speak in kingly language, and they're used primarily to compare kind of earthly power structures, kings, rulers, to God. And so that's what we're going to do today. We're going to look at God's care and concern from a grand scope. So not just how does he rule over my life, but how does God rule over everything? And what does that mean for how we live? What does it mean that God cares not just for Christians and the church, but he cares for everyone? And what does that mean for us? So let's get into it. Psalm chapter 2, verse 1. This is what it says. It says, "Why do the nations rage and the peoples plot in vain? The kings of the earth set themselves and the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, 'Let us burst their bonds apart and cast away their cords from us.'" So the psalmist begins with a question. The question that the psalmist begins with here is, why do the nations rage and the people plot in vain? Another way to say this is, why can't we all just get along, right? Which is a good question. It's a question that every person in the world has to deal with on one level or another, right? We all have to deal with the fact that the world is not what it should be. People aren't supposed to fight like this. People aren't supposed to suffer like they do. There's a lot of things that just aren't fair. We all see this. But we don't just share in the disillusionment. We also are together in finding a solution to it. Right, all the way back in Genesis 1, when God created the world, he gave what's called the cultural mandate. Right, be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and subdue it. Say all the time, that's not just about having babies. We have that part covered, people, right? This is about what we're doing to build culture and actually create systems within this world. Now, you might just think, okay, well, that was at the beginning. That was before sin. Now everything's messed up. But God actually doubled down on this command. He gave the same exact command to Noah when Noah came out of the ark, right? God spares Noah and his family from the flood. They come off, they build an altar, and God says, still the same task. Be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth, and subdue it. And then he gives them some additional laws on the Noach covenant. I'm not going to go into that today, but he gives them these additional laws, and these additional laws are the foundation for government, the foundation for kind of justice. But all this is to say, this idea of subduing the earth and creating systems that actually are good for humanity, this isn't just a task for the people of God. This is something that all people should be doing. All people should be working together in this effort to make this world a better place, us included. Right? So we all share this common goal, and we all feel the failure surrounding it. Right? So we all have a role, and we all know we're not doing very well. And where we differ is in what we think the solution to the problem is. Right? If you've ever gone to a community meeting, you see this, right? Everyone's mad. All right? So everyone's comes there and they've all got their reasons why they're there and they're mad and they're going to tell people, okay. But everyone has a different perspective on what the problem is. As a matter of fact, a good portion of the time, what this person thinks is the problem is what this person thinks is the solution. And they yell at each other. And it's fun. Right? No, this is what causes the rage, right? Because the rage comes from the fact that not only are things messed up, not only are things not how they should be, but there's people out there preventing us from making it right. Those people who are supposed to be working with us are instead working against us. So we spend all of our time refuting their ideas and insulting their perspective, usually insulting them as well. Right? Politics 2018. But all this really does is makes us feel more trapped, more hopeless, and further from any sort of peace. And so what the psalmist does here is he reframes what the problem is for us. He gives us a different perspective to look at what is actually going on. The big problem is not that we can't agree between us. The bigger problem is that we are all alienated from God. The main conflict in this world is not us versus them, however you want to define that. It's human beings versus God. And as much as we would like to believe that we are on God's team, the reality is we are all squarely on team people. And what happens is this separation from God causes us to plot in vain. Now, this plotting in vain usually doesn't look like standing on your front porch and kind of, you know, yelling at God. If you do that, your neighbors will think interesting things of you. No, the way that we feel this battle with God is in the fact that we do what we think is right. And it's actually kind of like creation fights back. Right? God has an order to creation. We don't actually live based on that order, and it doesn't go well. Now, the psalmist here attaches this action of fighting against God to kings. Right? It's the rulers who set themselves. The rulers take counsel together. Now, the reason why the focus is on the people at the top is because the rest of us live under the system that they set up. They're the ones who have the power to kind of create the world that we live in. Sure, we all have individual choices to make, but these decisions are not made in a vacuum. We live within a system where the rules are set by our earthly rulers, both through legislation and through example. And so in a certain sense, we don't entirely control our lives. We live within boundaries that have been dictated to us. And the problem here is all people live in a system that has been set up against God. Now, what do I mean by that? Well, we live in a world where power and money and self-confidence and prestige are the things that make the world go round. These are the forces by which things happen. But these aren't only the ways to advance the agenda. In a lot of ways, these things have become the agenda. We are trying to get more money. We are trying to get more power. We are trying to get more authority. And so the purpose of human life, as it has been framed for people who live in 21st century America, has been boiled down to a few simple principles, really, right? Enjoy yourself, don't hurt other people, be true to you. And we kind of accept this, sometimes, you know, bathe it in some Christian language, but ultimately we kind of live that out in our own way. Now, the problem is that system has nothing to do with God. It has nothing to do with the gospel. And so the major force of human movement that we are part of, right, towards human beings getting good things, feeling good about themselves, finding people they like that benefit them, where you're in control of your own life and able to, like, all of these things that we think are what life is about go against how God has created the world to be. So we need to recognize that in this cosmic battle, this struggle between God and his creation, we are both part of and perpetuating an anti-God approach to life. All of us. This is a very, very positive sermon, isn't it? Aren't you all glad you're here? Seems a bit daunting. How do we get out of this? The psalmist goes on. This is what he says in verse 4. He who sits in the heavens laughs, and the Lord holds them in derision. Then he will speak to them in his wrath and terrify them in his fury, saying, as for me, I have set my king on Zion, my holy hill. So this is where the reorientation starts to happen, right? We've been kind of given a picture of who we are. We don't really like it. We need a way to shift, to change. The psalmist here has recast us from the idea of ourselves we like to think of as kind of free entities on God's side against evil into kind of part of the problem. But the second stanza helps us, because what it does is it shifts us over to God's perspective. It makes three statements here that are very hopeful, even though they won't sound like it at first. But bear with me. The first statement it makes is this: God laughs at our attempts. Now, as I said, that doesn't sound very hopeful. It actually sounds quite condescending. Right? As we struggle through this life with the pain and the difficulty, the thought of God in heaven laughing at us seems a bit cruel. But the laugh that we see here attributed to God is not a laugh of enjoyment. God's laugh here is laughing at how pathetic our attempts at overcoming him are. To God, our ideas of what this world needs are so simple and so short-sighted that from his sovereign perspective, he can do nothing but laugh at the foolishness. Which is the best news that I have heard in my entire life. Because when I look at the world around me, I see problems that seem too big, too complex, problems that I've tried to fix myself or play a role in and feel like I got nowhere. All of this leads me to a place of hopelessness. Now, this might just be my cynical side speaking, and I do have that cynical side. It's about 4/5 of me, right? But I don't see human advancement as something that's going to take care of this problem. The next great idea is not going to solve the problems of this world. Again, that sounds pretty hopeless. What we need is a God who is so much greater, so much bigger, big enough that he looks at the most brilliant people that we have and goes, that's the best you have? Because it means that he is so far above that he could have an answer that is right enough, true enough, powerful enough to make sense of our experience that often, honestly, is senseless. We need a God who is far beyond us. But in order for a God that big to be good, we have to kind of know that he's on our side. Which is the second thing the psalmist says here. Well, actually, he goes on. I got one more semi-negative one first. All right. Second thing that he says, actually, is that God is furious. Right? In the same way that God is far greater in understanding than we are, he is also much more offended by sin. We tend to feel the weight of sin in pieces. Right? We tend to feel sin by how it affects us. So if someone sins against us, man, we feel it. We hate it. But God feels every human sin. Because every act of evil in this world, every act of evil is first an attack on him. And so while we hate suffering, while we hate sin to an extent, God's wrath towards sin is of a completely different variety. We hate sin that affects us negatively. God hates all sin. Now, this is a problem for us. It's a problem for us because, as we said before, we are sinners. We are part of the sin group. Most of the time when we want things to be fixed, what we're thinking of is God coming in and taking away the things that we think are negative. But if God is actually going to come in and take care of all sin, if we go, God, come, clean it up, that means he takes us out too. Right? We usually don't think about the fact that if God is going to be consistent, his attack against evil would include destroying each and every one of us. So we need a God who cares enough to hate evil, yet loves enough to allow the space for people to come to him. And he needs to give them a way to do that. We need a God who is both patient and a God who has a plan. That's a third thing the psalmist points to here, that God is actively working. God does not just sit back and allow things to play out. God is always working in his creation. And his active presence in his creation is described here in the phrase, I have set my king on Zion. I am ruling over the world through my king. Which is a twofold statement. First, it is saying God is working now. God is working now through the king David. See, this psalm isn't attributed to anyone in particular, but in the book of Acts, Paul tells us that these words here come from David. So we can assume David is the one writing. King David was a man who was anointed by God to lead the people of Israel. God gave him authority and God directed him in a way that allowed David to lead as God's chosen leader. So God was actively leading his people through David. And it was in the reign of David that God made a promise to the nation of Israel, another covenant called the Davidic covenant. Davidic covenant says this, is in 2 Samuel 7, your house and your kingdom shall be made sure forever before me, and your throne shall be established forever. Right? So not only was David ruling over the people, and not only was David's rule a time when Israel lived in quite a bit of prosperity, but God promised, I will always lead my people through your family line. Now, at the time, it was assumed that that would mean that David would hand the throne down to his son Solomon, and then Solomon would hand it down to his son, and he would hand it down to his son, and he would hand it, I could keep going forever, right? But it would stay in the family line forever. It would just keep going. But that didn't pan out. It didn't take that many generations before that fell apart, and all of a sudden, the people were going, wait, I thought God made a promise. What's going on? which is where we see the second part of what is being said here. My king is on Zion, that God is working behind the scenes. So he's present and actively working to lead us in this world, but he's also working behind the scenes. And when God says, I have set my king on Zion, he is referring to Jesus, the one who comes in the line of David, who sets his rule forever. He is assuring the people that while at this time their king seems pretty similar to the rest of the kings in the world, there is a king coming who is vastly different. A king whose kingship would be universal. And what this shows us is that we can't measure what God is doing through just what we see. We can't measure how effective God is simply by what's happening in front of us. Because if we measure God by the systems of this world, it's easy to always feel defeated. Right? Think about Israel as they went, oh man, we lost our kings and now we're in captivity. What is God doing? God's still working. If we define what God is supposed to be doing, if we say human flourishing is success and happiness, and well, then we're always going to look at God and say, you failed. So we need to reorient the way that we see God based on his view of the world. The psalmist helps us do that here in verse 7. He says this. He says, I will tell of the decree. The Lord said to me, you are my son. Today I have begotten you. Ask of me, and I will make the nations your heritage and the ends of the earth your possession. You shall break them with a rod of iron and dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel. All right, so while this is written a long time before Jesus ever came, this is about Jesus. We know that because this section of the psalm is actually the most quoted section of psalm in the New Testament. It's quoted three different times, once in Acts and twice in Hebrews, all of which are saying, this is what God was promising. Way back, God was promising that he would bring the Messiah. Specifically in Hebrews 1, it says it this way. This is Hebrews 1, 1. It says, long ago, at many times and in many ways, God spoke to our fathers by the prophets. But in these last days, he has spoken to us by his Son, who he appointed the heir of all things, through whom he also created the world. He is the radiance of the glory of God and the exact imprint of his nature, and he upholds the universe by the word of his power. After making purification for sins, he sat down at the right hand of the majesty on high, having become as much superior to the angels as the name he has inherited is more excellent than theirs. For to which of the angels did God ever say, you are my son, today I have begotten you? That's where it's quoting the psalm. But what this is showing us is that God orchestrated all of human history to be the backdrop for the gospel of Jesus Christ. Right? Jesus does not appear in time as much as all of time exists for him. And it describes Jesus here in a few different ways. He is the Son begotten of the Father, which simply means he is the way that God describes himself most completely to his creation. Right? He is the radiance of the glory of God and the exact imprint of his nature. Secondly, he is the heir of all things. It says, I will make the nations your heritage and the end of the earth your possession. Jesus is the one who has authority over everything. He sits at the right hand of God, which means he is in a place of ruling, of kingship. He upholds the universe by the word of his power. Everything that happens, happens because he proclaims it to be. And then he is the ultimate judge of all things. The psalm says, you shall break them with a rod of iron and dash them in pieces like a potter's vessel, which is a simple way of saying, I don't know if it's simple, it is a way of saying that all evil, all sin, all suffering will be dealt with. Everything will see justice. So Jesus is the completion of God's plan. He's the pinnacle of the story. He is the means by which God not only saves us from our sin, but the way that he makes us righteous and able to be in relationship with him. Jesus raises from the dead. He declares himself victorious, not only victorious over death, but victorious over all sin and evil. He then ascends to heaven and takes that spot on the throne where he can rule over all of creation. This is our King. Which leads us to the question, okay, but where do we fit into all that? Well, evil and suffering are not just a continual reminder that something is wrong with this world. They're also a continual reminder for us that there's something wrong with us. That we need help. We aren't the saviors of this world who are going to go out and save it. We need a savior. And in Jesus, we have one. In Jesus, we have a God who doesn't run away because we continue to sin against him, right? We are attacking him, and he is drawing us in. He doesn't reject us as his enemies, even though that's what we have declared ourselves to be. He comes to us, and then he gives of himself so that we can be in relationship with him, which is the only thing we ever needed. That's what we were created for. But then we ask, okay, so then what are we supposed to be doing here, right? That's great, salvation, but what role do we play in any sort of helping the world? What are we supposed to do with this time while we still live here? Well, in 1 Peter 2, God makes a declaration as to who we now are. As people that have been invited into the family of God, he says, you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for his own possession, that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. Which is to say, we are now a holy nation in the midst of an earthly nation that we have been called to now partner with and play a role in to bring things more and more in line with God. So we go, how do we do that? I know, I'm asking a lot of questions. Verse 10, the psalmist says this, now therefore, O kings, be wise. Be warned, O rulers of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear and rejoice with trembling. Kiss the Son, lest he be angry and you perish in the way, for his wrath is quickly kindled. Blessed are all who take refuge in him. All right, so he addresses the kings once again, right? So he talked to the kings, then he pulled back and he talked about Jesus. Now he's addressing the kings again, which should make us think, okay, this isn't just about the personal. This is talking about who we are in relation to the larger culture. And he describes how we're supposed to act in contrasting imperatives. We talked last week about Hebrew poetry and parallelism. One of the forms of parallelism is contrast. And these contrasts are used to show us the complexity of what we're supposed to do. Things that seem like they're not the same, that all of a sudden we see go together. Show you what I mean. The first one is this, be wise and be warned. Wisdom usually is thought of in a pretty positive direction, warning pretty negative. But the two actions that the psalmist describes for us here, the two things that we should be doing in our daily lives on a regular basis, is to promote what is good and to call out what is bad. And we can do this because as Christians we have been given the Spirit. The Spirit helps us to see the world through the eyes of God. Not perfectly, but we can see in a way that people who are not connected to God cannot. But this clarity that we now have is not just ours to kind of hoard. See how much better we are than other people? Sure, I'm glad that God gave us these new eyes. No, we're supposed to actually use those to benefit other people. By first promoting what is good. Anything and everything that is in line with God's goodness should be encouraged and supported. We should align with it. We should give our time and energy to it. And it doesn't have to be bathed in spiritual terminology or connected to the church. Our goal should be to shift the cultural system. We want all in this nation, whether they're connected to God or not, to see the value of human life, to care for the less fortunate, to build strong families. Our idea of what is good must come from Scripture. We don't get to just decide what we think is good. But we don't need to restrict ourselves to the confines of our Christian circles. We want to make what God says is good exciting to the world. We should want all people to experience flourishing. The kind of flourishing that comes from getting in rhythm with God, living by His order. But it also means we have to call out what is bad. Because while we want to help the world honor God and experience joy of being in line with Him, we also know that that's not enough. Right? So we should be acting in this direction, but never kind of turning ourselves entirely into these kinds of people who basically throw the gospel out in order to do good works. Because we can do all sorts of healing of evil and suffering and then leave people, well, in their sin to just create a whole bunch more. And so while we should promote good in areas that are not Christian, in our jobs, in our neighborhoods, in our social groups, we should never do this to the detriment of the gospel. God's common grace, His love for all of creation, should not get in the way of His specific grace, His love for His people. The psalmist continues with another contrasting imperative here. He says, we should serve and rejoice. Serve, because doing this kind of work is hard. If we're going to change the systems of this world, if we're actually going to move the needle a little bit, it means we can't just go with the path of least resistance. It means choosing to do a lot of things that you don't want to do in this moment. Doing God's work is work. It requires day in and day out commitment to His mission. And I will just say, I don't know what has happened to the church in the last 30 years, but we've gotten freaking lazy. I don't know who we think is supposed to do the work of God, but we keep going like, somebody should be doing that. It's hard. But it's our work. We should be looking for places to serve others as a means to promote God's goodness in the community. And when it gets hard, we should keep going. Had somebody ask me this week, when are you going to learn the word no? I said, when some other people learn the word yes. We should all be doing our part here. But in this, we must also rejoice. It's not all work. The work we get to do is glorious. There's so much good all of the time. And if you really dig in and connect with what God is doing, you get to see, you get to be front row seats of what God is doing in this world. So we have to balance work with celebrating God's good. And this is described in the last complementing contrast, act and take refuge. Which is to say this, the reason why we can give and give and give is not because we have the strength on our own. It's not this kind of like, you know, you need to be more self-willed in moving forward. No, the source of being able to do God's work and keep going, right? The power to take the burden of others, it comes from resting in God. Right? To take refuge in Jesus means that we aren't beat down by the hopelessness of working hard and feeling like we're barely making a dent, because that's often what happens. You commit yourself to doing something and you think you're going to do a whole lot, and then you get into it and you're like, this is not really moving in the way that I thought. I quit. It's like every other thing that we start as a church, right? Get four steps in, too hard, I quit. To take refuge means that we're not overcome when we give to someone and it returns to us in hate and accusation. You know, if you've ever done that, you give to someone, you give to someone, you give to someone, and they're like, you're trying to change me. Yeah, maybe a little, but then you're like, oh, I don't want to do that. I put so much into this. I remember one time we were helping some folks move, and it was like, I think it was a battered women's home up in Bellingham, and we were helping them move, and they didn't box up any of their stuff. Like, there was stuff all over the place. And I walked in, and I was like, don't they know we're helping them? They can help us a little bit here. One of the other guys who was a little more mature was like, hey, jerk face. Oh, thanks. Sorry, I'm so off the rails right now. All right. To take refuge in Jesus means we aren't defeated by what we see as failure. We let God define where he's taking this. Again, the people of Israel in the Old Testament would have looked at where things are and God is not here, he has no plan, he's abandoned us, we better take it on our own. The truth of the matter is he was always there. He was always working. We have been assured of complete justice. We have been told that Jesus wins. Our King is on the throne. We can set aside our fears and work and move forward. But ultimately, our benefit for the nations, our benefit for anybody outside of these walls, begins with what we do here. Because if within the church we are not already taking refuge in Jesus, if we are not practicing service towards one another, if we're not promoting good in the lives of the people around us and actually caring about the person who's sitting next to you that you've never met before, if we are not warning of bad and where people are going off the rails, then we will not be mature enough to do it outside of here. If we're not doing it here, we're not all of a sudden going to have some sort of epiphany once we step outside those doors. Our shifting of the greater culture begins with the culture that we build here in our church. And specifically, it begins with an act of submission. Submitting our way, what we think is good, what we think is best for our lives, to what God says is. And we come here every week to practice that. Not only to have his word meet us, but also to come to him in communion. Because while in communion we receive from God, coming to communion is an act of submission. And so come to the table today, recognizing that you need what Jesus offers in his body and blood. You need what he has. But also recognize that this gift connects us to the mission to bring all creation into alignment with his will. Allow God to give you a big view of what he is doing and recommit yourself to taking your place in his mission today. Let's pray. Father, we thank you so much for the promises that you make and